Are you Invictus? Clint, are you Invictus? Are you Invictus?
What does it mean?
You know, when I started the Invictus Mind podcast, my goal was to unite a bunch of people who had a similar ideology or similar characteristic traits. Invictus means unconquerable. It's an old Greek word for means unconquerable.
Unconquerable.
So, honestly, just be totally honest, it was a new concept to me. I had to Google it when you sent it to me. But yeah, I do my best.
Tell me about what the show, what is your audience looking for? Tell me.
This is your first time here. This is the number one program dedicated to helping individuals maximize their potential and truly become unconquerable. Here we have discussions about what it takes and what it means to experience and magnify political freedom, financial freedom, and spiritual freedom.
Yes, I would absolutely say that. I'm going to keep getting up, right? And I keep getting up and I keep pushing forward. And that's the type of mindset that you need to have.
I never lose hope. I never lose faith. My mindset has always been, if I want something, I don't give up.
So let me tell you what is the number one issue when it comes to being unconquerable.
Okay.
And the number one word you have to think about here is not intelligence, not savvy, not strength, none of those things. The number one thing is resilience.
You know I'm Invictus. Come on. All right. I'm Invictus AF.
Well, may I have an initiation question for my tribe?
Okay.
Are you Invictus?
I believe I am.
So yes, I agree. I am Invictus.
I totally agree, man. And I think that if there's anybody on this planet that's unconquerable, it's probably me. I am not the type to take orders. And I am definitely in a position that I can stand up for myself right now. So.
And I was like, no way. I know what that word means now.
yeah, man. Very cool concept for a show.
You didn't ask me if I was Invictus.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Invictus Mind podcast. As always, this is your host, Mike Corbell. If you are tuning in for the first time, this is the number one place to learn how to achieve and magnify your political freedom, financial freedom, and spiritual freedom. Before we get started, I only ask a simple question. If you like this show, please go ahead and give it a rating on Apple, or if you listen to any other platform, please let everyone know why you like what we are doing, and feel free to let us know what you think can be improved upon or what we should change. Also, please share this program with three of your friends. That is truly the only way we can grow and get this message out to larger audiences. For that, I thank you. And in return, I will promise to continue bringing you great content. All right. Coming on the program with me today is a man I met on podmatch.com. That is a great matchmaker website for podcasters, as well as those who wish to appear to be on other shows. I do have an affiliate with that company. So if you're a person who wants to get your message out to the public, if you feel like being on podcasts, or if you are a podcaster, there is a great link that you can check out to be with that program. Recently, I was having a conversation with my wife about why every single commercial you see on TV is from a pharmaceutical company. You know, there's always some kind of potion or pill that they want you to have to solve some kind of ailment, even though it seems every single pill comes with a disclaimer about the side effects one might get if they get on a prescription. And so, obviously, we just came off a two-year pharmaceutical tyrannical nightmare, in my opinion, and the healthcare industry has needed dramatic changes for a long time. So today I'm going to talk with a person who we're going to come up with some solutions possibly to address those problems. I'm talking with a surgeon. He's actually a dual board certified general and colon rectal surgeon. He also teaches faculty at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, California. He is the founder and CEO of USO.com, the first successful model of peer-to-peer coverage, and he serves on numerous boards. He's a father of four, happily married, and is an amateur triathlete. Please help me welcome Dr. Alan Kamavra. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Great.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. So, you know, your profile on PodMatch says that you're a polymath.
So it's funny that the... Having a startup, I've had a number of meetings with VCs. I actually didn't know the term until a couple of partners at different firms said, you know, you are the prototypical polymath. And I said, well, that sounds great. And I had to go look it up because I actually had never even heard it. And I called one of my key advisors and said, that's probably the best compliment I've ever gotten in my life. And so I've always loved that.
Well, being a medical doctor and a surgeon means that you had definitely a lot of education in your past. And you know, not only are you successful in that industry, but you've started two companies of your own, which seem to be going pretty well. So that that means you've done more than most people, which is a perfect fit for this show. So thank you for coming on.
Of course.
You know, when we connected, we were talking about the pharmaceutical industry. Now, understanding, and I want to respect your position in the industry, there's probably some negative things that we both could agree about in the pharmaceutical industry. But, I'd like to turn the time over to you to just kind of share your story about, you know, the way you see things and, you know, what changes you hope to see going forward. Why are so many people struggling, it seems, because of this this behemoth that seems to be lying over everyone's head?
Yeah, I mean, it's multifaceted. There is the component that the United States is one of the only, if not the only, let's just say one of, just in case there are exceptions, countries out there that still, to some extent, respects IP rights, intellectual property rights. And so in many ways, Americans are subsidizing innovation in research and discovery for pharmaceuticals for the rest of the world. And so other countries are living off the backs of us as Americans funding the cost for future research. Let's say that's one of them. The other one that comes to my mind, and it leads to the startup USO that I had started, is that medicine is a multi-trillion dollar industry in the US alone. I think just a couple of years ago, the number was 3.8 trillion was the overall industry size for healthcare. And what that means is there's a big pot of gold. And the way payments have been set up in the health industry is, how do we maximize our draw from that pot of gold? And that's for everyone, even physicians. It's for hospitals, for physicians, for ancillary providers, even patients. And so the way we have set up how that system works is, we have a pot of gold, and if you can give us a reason to draw from it, you can draw. And I think all of that compounds upon itself to lead to this system where, what are the costs? You know, I always made the kind of example that when I was 16, and I had my first car and I needed an oil change, my father would sit there and clip coupons and say, hey, you're driving 10 miles out east to get an oil change because they have the cheapest coupon that's going to be, you know, make it cheap. And I'd sit there and drive. Gas was cheaper then. Mm-hmm. But the reason was that we were personally responsible for that fee. Now, if you consider in healthcare, what's happening is there's a third party payer that is only retrospectively involved with the transaction. They have actually very little decision-making on the day-to-day. And so you see a physician, you see a care provider, and they say, you need to do this. Sure. Does anyone in that equation know what anything costs? The physician typically doesn't know what it costs. The patient doesn't know what it costs. They don't even know at the point of transaction. A lot of times patients will come to me and say, how much will this surgery cost? And I'll say, I just don't know. I really don't. And most don't. We find out after we send a bill, and then the insurers send it back to us. And so the system for us in healthcare is, people need care. They have no idea what things cost, and they only find out after the fact. And there's another party payer after that. And so if you were to consider the oil change analogy that I gave with my father, if his other calculus was, oil changes are included with our insurance, end stop. Say, go get your oil change. And what would happen, instead of paying 15 bucks for an oil change, you know, and driving a distance to get to it, I'd go to the closest one to my house at a convenience, mm-hmm. and they would charge whatever the heck they want. And over time, you would have to have procedure codes and how much do people charge and what is usual and customary for an oil change and the average, because the person who's paying is not at all involved in the equation. And I've always thought that there should be, part of where the system broke is that patients don't pay upfront on very little other than co-pays. But if instead we told patients, hey, you want to have a colonoscopy, to take it from my own field, you could pay for that and you will get reimbursed by the insurer from us. That would change the calculus for the patient to make sure that they're not being overcharged, that they're not getting things that are unnecessary, because they may actually be more held liable if the insurers don't pay them back, because they have to foot that bill up front. And what we've done is, the person who really should be the decision maker, that patient, is not part of the equation really in terms of the costs. Really, they're not. They are to some extent, like pharmaceutical, it does change because they'll go to the pharmacy and pay But if we look at kind of where the costs are just going crazy and out of control in medicine, I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing up that analogy. I was thinking about that myself. You know, I'm actually in the healthcare industry as an insurer provider. You know, a producer is probably the proper term. You know, I sell insurance, health insurance, and life insurance and everything like that. And as I was studying for my health insurance license years ago, I remember somebody bringing up that same analogy about getting an oil change. You wouldn't expect your car to be covered by the insurance, or your oil change to be covered by the insurance company. Why are you doing routine checkups at the doctor with your insurance, which just drives up the cost? At the same time, I was also learning about how Medicare and Medicaid came into the equation and really removed the relationship that the doctor and a patient had together to discuss and negotiate procedures and costs. Nature that all went away, several years ago.
Yeah, it did. And so, it's to what you're saying is, if you know the real good example is if you go to a hospital and you have insurance, what a lot of hospitals have now are management consulting firms that tell them how to maximize coding, because everything we do on patients is code based. What are the codes you could use on this patient to get the most money from that hospitalization? Doesn't mean it's necessary, but as long as you code it, well, then they're going to pay it. And so it's not uncommon for physicians to get a call from one of the consultants and say, hey, if you change or add this word to your notes, we can make an additional $50,000. And compare that to, for instance, if a patient who comes in uninsured to the hospital. Well, if you're uninsured and you go to the hospital, you don't have an insurance plan to pay for your care, but physicians and the hospital are still, they still have an oath to give you the best care and keep you alive. And so, believe it or not, right now, in a weird way, uninsured people who walk into the hospital who, let's say, need an emergency surgery or need care may get more efficient and effective care than the insured. And it's an abstract statement to what I'm saying. And what the reason I'm saying it is, when somebody comes in insured, especially when they're like, oh, this one has good insurance, what happens is they consult every physician under the sun. They get physical therapy involved. They get an extra MRI. They get an extra CT. They get extra labs. There's a process in place to maximize that draw from the insurer. We can get as much as we can. Let's maximize the worth of this patient to the hospital. And the only way you do that is by procedures and services and tests and consultants. Patients uninsured, there is no fund. And so they say, you need your gallbladder out. We will get it out and we'll get you out of the hospital as soon as humanly possible, which is the best care, versus let's bring you in and get an MRCP and an MRI and get a physical therapist to see you. And oh, let's also get this person to see you in case there's an issue with your hemorrhoid. And that is not actually good care. Right? You know, human beings health-wise do better the less involved physicians can be. And so the system is all focused on that fund and access to that fund. And it's partly because how you get access to that fund is obscured. And so it's this code system. And so it's how do you fix those? And I think a lot of it is to what you just said. It's the way the foundational aid system is set up. And unless we reinvent that, I don't know how we get out of it.
Right. Because now you're talking about incentives. You know, obviously insurers, their incentives are to make money off of people's premiums. And so as long as they keep people coming in and paying, the insurance companies will get money. And the doctors, you know, some of them are just revolving doors. They just bring the patient in, give them some kind of medicine, some kind of treatment, and just send them out, just like what you said, send them to another doctor. And so I imagine it's very hard to create a good lasting relationship between doctor and patient.
It's different. I mean, that's an interesting question. So I agree with you. There are a lot of physicians now that are revolving doors. People come in and they have a set of procedures that they will do on them just because there's a payment that comes with it. And not necessarily because it's needed, but overall, because the risk of it is small. You know, if you consider how many people are getting routine EKGs and cardiac workups at young ages and they're healthy, is that because they truly need that or because there's an incentive structure in place? Because as physicians, we get less and less money to just have that doctor-patient relationship and much more for the procedures which we affect upon. And so the system, without realizing it, has made it that you want to survive financially, start doing procedures over and over again. Make that patient come to you for more and more procedures. One in particular for my field in colorectal is you could do hemorrhoid treatments. And so there are physicians that will say, why don't you come in and we'll do 8 sessions of injections or bandings on your hemorrhoids. Completely unnecessary. But there are moments where to do a 5-minute injection of a hemorrhoid, we actually get reimbursed better than what a colonoscopy pays now. And colonoscopies just don't pay well anymore. You know, I think Blue Shield reimburses at like $147 for an entire procedure, which is just, it doesn't make sense economically from a time value management of my time. And so those things are corrupting that process. And it, to what you said, that was what I was thinking about, was so the principal thing we did when we founded USO was how do we disconnect the revenue of the coverage mechanism? We are not an insurer, so I'm not going to say us as an insurance company, but how do we disconnect our revenue so that no matter what the cost of care is, we are agnostic to it? If I can make us agnostic to what the cost of care is and the flow of funds in the system, then we should have a system in place where we can work to our members' advantage to lower those costs over time. They will always be a cost. There will always be inflation, but to decrease those inflationary forces. The veterinary medicine the last 2 years has had estimates of 30 to 50% increase over 2 years in the costs of veterinary care. And healthcare is the same. And so it's solving that. And so, and I'll stop there. I'll say one last thing and stop because I'm monologuing, is people don't realize that the insurance model, they make revenue as a percentage of total premiums. And for instance, in healthcare, it's pegged at 20% under the Affordable Care Act. They can't take more than 20% as revenue and stop. So what does that mean? If you need to make $60 to manage someone's care, but your actuaries come and say, look, it's looking like you only need 100 for this plan next year. It's like, well, 100, we're only making 20. We need it to be 300. Mm-hmm. Well, then drive up the costs to make sure those goals are there, one. And two, allow that industry that you are involved in to hyperinflate, because your revenue will hyperinflate as a direct proportion.
Right, right. So, you know, it is all about incentives. You know, I really like the peer-to-peer method of healthcare that I'm learning about. Of course, I think your company was the primary example in peer-to-peer, but you mentioned veterinary. Now, you're a surgeon, but you're not also a vet, are you?
No, I'm not. No, we had started, the entire mission of USO isn't to get in healthcare one day, but we want to do it right. And this isn't to say others aren't doing it right. I'm not making a judgment at all. We had looked at the landscape. There had been some peer-to-peer attempts in Europe and abroad. Most of them had failed, short of one in China, which was called Water Drop under Tencent. And because it was in China and they distributed it through WeChat, it became exceedingly popular. And actually became the number one form of coverage in China within a year for human healthcare. And what they did is they would do microtransactions through WeChat for coverage across the country. And I think they hit some insane number of like 70 million users within a couple months, like very quickly, something that can only happen in the Chinese market. And if you're distributed through WeChat, and for listeners that don't know, WeChat is everything in China. It is your wallet. It is how people communicate. It's how people, they call out to the US. It's every person in China is on WeChat. Like, it doesn't exist. I remember being in a taxi cab and wanting to pay cash. And said, no cash, WeChat. It's literally that ingrained into the system. And so we had met with a few of the reinsurers. We have partners in the reinsurance world. And one of the discussions was, look, you have an amazing model here. It's all working. What should you go in first? And then we came into PET. PET was a very final kind of decision. Ours was really, how do we build a universal model to reinvent the concept of insurance and coverage? There is no regulatory structure to contemplate models like this. And I think people forget that at its core, insurance is crowdfunding, right? The first model of a global crowdfund was insurance. But insurance at its core is just crowdfunding at massive scale. But the money that people get at reimbursements is what the insurers collect as premiums from people. And so what we had perspected was using the advents of technology, think Venmo, PayPal, Stripe, can we not utilize those to potentially build a newer model that's more efficient and transparent? And most importantly, realigns interests so that we can effectuate or make changes to an industry to help control costs. So I'll stop on this part to this, Mike, but it was we launched part of our veterinaries. We launched something called True Vet. And our users could go onto our website and they look up, they could look up a procedure and it'll tell them the cost, the average cost of that procedure, but then also cross-reference their zip code and say, here are all the vets in your area. These ones are charging a very fair price. These ones are an incredibly good price. And these ones are expensive. And if you, and these are other costs. If you've ever gone to a vet, they will line item a million other costs when you go to them. Oh, you need this and you need this, or you need IVs. These are the things you can expect them to line item and what on average others are getting charged for those. And if you want, here are other vets in the reviews, and you could search those vets to see what they're charging people, because otherwise you won't have those fees available to you. Only because we're aligned with our members to not drive up costs can we unleash that data and make our users smart users. And that was the final key, was to be able to be a model where it doesn't hurt us to have very smart users with all the information at their disposal.
And see, I think that's brilliant, because one of the things I noticed just in the world in general, not just for pet owners, but for just when you talk about human healthcare, is that how many people out there actually know what they need when they're sick? How many people know? I mean, how many people can really feel confident that they can trust their doctor when there might be opposing points of view on social media, or there might be messages, mixed messages about what pill you need to take, you know, what drug, what procedure. And then, of course, you stick it in an insurance company that just has an incentive to get paid and push you through the system. But, you know, I really like the peer-to-peer model. And it makes sense that you start in the pet industry. I mean, yeah. Obviously, you want to try something out. And I just learned about pet insurance just a couple of years ago. I'm not a pet owner, although my wife wants to get a dog one day. So we're going to be turned on to that eventually. But I imagine that, you know, people who own pets, that's a member of your family, right? You want to make sure that pet has the healthcare provided. And, you know, what I'm noticing is that when people can't afford procedures for their pets, a member of their family, the costs will just help them make decisions that just could break their hearts. I mean, yeah, you see the early demise of animals because they're not getting proper healthcare.
Yeah, I think the estimate, at least a couple of years ago, was 2 million dogs euthanized a year because of the cost. So they call it economic euthanasia. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the calculus. People will get a pet and say, up to this amount we will spend, and after that, like, time for a replacement. You can't do that with a child. And it was part of the reason we thought pet was a very good first launch for us, because it has a lot of the similarities of healthcare. No one knows what things cost when they go to the vet. They don't really know about the diseases. There's pharmaceutical medications that they have to pay for. And there's surgeries, there's hospitalizations. It is a loved one. And so it has a lot of the same dynamics that you would have in healthcare, which is probably the most complicated model.
Right.
Prove it in that, then build and go big, be it in healthcare. But actually, one of the things we're discussing is, you know, the application of this model, for instance, in Web3. And so we're talking to investors now, in the process of actually raising our next large round. And it's that, is this something we want to go just to healthcare, or is this a Web3 application, because it's a democratized or a decentralized version of coverage? And the principal thing being, and why it's not insurance, right? We can't get, even if I said, you know what, I want insurance, I want to be an insurer. There's nothing we do that fits the model. There's no regulatory kind of blueprint to allow us to exist. And so we've had a couple of states, Washington be one. It's like, well, we don't know what to classify you as, but we just don't like you. Literally what they told us.
Wow.
And, you know, there's a couple others we're talking to, and I was actually on with their attorney general for one of these states recently. And he said, you know, but you still feel to us like insurance. I said, okay, I want to apply for certificate of authority. How? We don't have any of the definitions, none, that will allow us to get that certificate, right? To be an insurer, you have to have what's called a COA, certificate of authority. Hmm. We don't meet any of the criteria, none. So at the first step of applying for the certificate, we don't meet the definition in any shape or form. We can't meet the definition because the model is so vastly different, but they want, because that's what they need to do. And I don't blame them. At some point, they're trying to do consumer value, consumer protection. We need those in some levels because there have been predatory companies out there. But what we really need to do is redefine the models to contemplate these changes in technology. You know, I'll tell you one funny one, Mike, and then I think you're honest. We, one of the states we're working with, they have a director of innovation. That's his role. And that's his role, is director of innovation for finance and insurance. And we're on the phone and he says, you know, there is really no such thing as innovation. And I'm literally, those are his words. I'm not even changing them because it was so profound. I said, you're the director. Because yeah, it's an oxymoron as a term. There's no such thing as innovation. Innovation is just more efficiency, but there is no true innovation. And I mean, what do you do with that conversation, right? There's people running these departments and they don't want to see changes in the industry. And that in itself is its own problem. How do you make an industry better if it's defined that it can only be one way? And I think those are things that do need to change.
Sure. So, you know, you said something and maybe you can help me understand a little bit more, because you mentioned that insurance at its core is crowdfunding, which obviously it is. You know, a bunch of people are paying premiums into a system, and that those premiums should be divided and, you know, obviously spread the cost of any procedure. But with a peer-to-peer crowdfunding operation, you said it doesn't meet the definition of insurance.
It doesn't.
Well, how is it different in their eyes?
Yeah. So in their eyes, they want us to be there because they want to regulate us. Okay. So they want us to apply for certificate of authority, but we can't. So what to be an insurer, because so I'm going to go a little historical. I hope it doesn't get too academic. Insurance started in the 1600s in London, and it started for the shipping. So those boats were going out to the colonies for shipments. And there was something actually pre-insurance called general average. And the general average is very much like what ourselves, Waterdrop, and CrowdHealth are doing without any efficiencies of technology. So Lloyd's comes around in the 1600s. This is literally how it all started, and said, we're going to build insurance. Now, this is 100 years before the telephone. Mm-hmm. So imagine a ship is going to the colonies, who knows, South Africa, Singapore, wherever it was going, and it goes down. And they need to call up on that claim, but they don't have a telephone. All they have is horse and carriage. And who knows if that person's actually in their home. They may themselves be, you know, in the 1600s, people were they were moving all over the place. You know, they may have been gone for 2 months at a time. How do you call upon that money without any technology? And so the answer was, you pay us up front an average of what we expect the entire year to just fall out to.
Sure.
Boom, you have insurance. And what they said is, look, if we're collecting £100 versus £1 million, our revenue should just be a percentage of what we're collecting. It actually makes sense. I don't think there's anything nefarious in that statement. It's just logical. Okay, you're collecting £100, make $20. £1 million, 20% of that. And so there's your insurance model. That model has not fundamentally changed, but what it requires is that the insurer has a fund that's sitting there captive, holding everyone's money. So we pay our premiums, it sits in what we call a surplus fund.
Right, okay.
To get a certificate of authority, you have to have a surplus fund. Now, what we have argued is that digital payments, technology, and decentralization has moved to such a point that we don't need to hold everyone's money captive in a fund. You can decentralize that into everyone's own accounts.
Okay.
And we as a company don't need to hold it. We don't have to be in control of it. And so in USO, with an insurer, you put in a claim, they draw from that central fund and reimburse you. With these decentralized models, you put in a claim, we approve it, and then we do microtransaction draws from everyone else's bank accounts. It's completely decentralized across them. There is no common fund. Without that common fund, a certificate of authority is impossible. It's one of the most important requirements to get it.
Okay.
And so that is, by definition, part of what it is to. Now, there's many other things that is insurance versus not. So in insurance, because you're prepaying into this fund, you're paying for a future risk. We are betting that into the future, this may happen.
Right, right.
In these decentralized models, because we can do things transactionally instantaneously and decentralize it across people's accounts, we no longer have to bet on the future. We can say, we will give you the exact charges for the month and draw only to that and nothing more. And anything unused, yours to keep and stock. And so our members commit up to a certain amount each month. If it's not used, it's theirs and only theirs, not for us.
Okay.
And because we're only drawing up to what's needed and nothing more. And it's a retrospective draw, not a prospective risk draw, if that makes sense.
So there is a subscription model of payment rather than a premium.
Yeah.
You have a certain payment you go up to, but you mentioned that if you pay too much and that service is not needed, then the customer will get reimbursed for paying more. Help me understand that a little bit.
So it's two parts, and that's where it gets confusing, and that's what it is till people get used to it. It will be confusing. It's a new model. What we've said is, one, incentives. Okay. We don't want to be part of the transaction of the cost of care. So our members pay us a membership fee to run the company, pay the Amazon server, cloud, all the pieces.
Right.
You know, my IT team, that's a flat fee and stop. That's the only money we take in. And it's, you know, 20 for dogs, 10 for cats.
Okay.
So that's just a fee to keep the lights on. And then there is, what is the cost of care on average if you have a community of, you know, spread across risk of different pets? And so for dogs, that's at 55, and for cats, it's at 25. The cats are just cheaper. And so up to $25 in community care costs, you will contribute each month if you're a cat, and up to 55 in dogs, but it's typically less.
Okay.
And so there have been months where our cat members have spent $5 on community care costs, and everything else was theirs. So that the kind of that 35 for cats, quote unquote, isn't a true 35. It is 35 max, but really whatever the costs are that month, and then they'll credit back to you.
I see. Okay. And what year did this, did you start this company?
Started the company in 2017, went live in 2018. So we've been live in the pet space for almost, you know, over 3.5 years. Guy Carpenter, one of the largest reinsurance brokerages groups, actually globally, they did a review at the 3-year mark, looked at our data. We actually just opened up our data. We were very happy with what we were seeing. Did a very detailed analysis. I mean, every point, and basically published a report that overall the savings were 47% to every member in the system if they had tried to get equal coverage with any other pet insurer in the market. And they commented that what they were seeing was that people were being better actors. So to everything you and I were talking about earlier, Mike, about just going to the doctor and spending blindly, they were noticing that there was a change in behavior in terms of how much people were spending at the vet and how frequently they were doing it, because they were very cognizant, because of the way the model is set, that they are drawing from other humans, not a big corporation.
Right. That makes sense. Makes sense. Well, cool. I mean, over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, you've seen your model be successful. Now, I was sharing with you before we started recording that I've seen this model in the human care healthcare industry. You know, so it's catching on. People are interested in that because, you know, the biggest concern that people have nowadays, and I'm just seeing it myself, the costs of healthcare are just skyrocketing, right?
It is.
Because of the incentive structure, and, you know, and just more and more people are just out there like confused about why healthcare is going up. They're confused about what procedures to take. And, you know, this is just human healthcare and pet healthcare. And it seems like you're just right there on the cutting edge with some good ideas right there. So.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is from my own experiences. I have an MBA. I've worked in medicine for a long time now. I've managed my own group practice. I've worked at private, you know, I actually worked at Kaiser for a bit. So I've seen the HMO side. I've seen the large academic side. So I've seen exposures to just about every type of model we have in the US. And so use that to say, well, how would we build something for, you know, coverage? And there's a huge gap there. So we know about the 30 million uninsured in the US still, even after the Affordable Care Act, but there's still what I call the underinsured, people who have Medicaid or Medicaid-based plans. Mm-hmm. They have what we call quote-unquote coverage, so the politicians can pat themselves on the back and say, look what we did. But in reality, they don't. They have coverage for a really bad car accident, or if they get shot, or some traumatic event. But if they want to see a physician for a run-of-the-mill type of problem, 80% of physicians don't accept Medicaid. And so they're really SOL in terms of actual care on a day-to-day basis. And so I say there's about 100 million people in the US that are either underinsured or uninsured. Mm-hmm. And that is a gap that needs to be solved for. And so those are the things that I see as ways to solve this, you know, a USO plan over a Medicaid plan. You have Medicaid, you end up in the hospital, you're fine, but you want to see a doctor day-to-day, you're stuck. There's a solution for you to be able to do day-to-day type of care and for it to be controlled.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, so exactly. Well, sorry, so you know, it's interesting that you know, the model you're talking about is something that will cover those uninsured people. You know, both, you know, pet owners, obviously that's what your industry is all about. Your business model is all about. But I think the human healthcare element is really good. When I was first hearing about it, it was aimed more at the entrepreneur type of person who, you know, is not going to be under some kind of employee healthcare plan, but also doesn't want to pay thousands of dollars, you know, a year just for the premium. So they can join this plan And, you know, they can pay a small subscription as opposed to high premium costs without, you know, having high deductibles and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a great plan. But what's interesting is that, you know, you decided that you were going to start a business as well as become a doctor. And I'm jesting because, you know, in my experience, I've met many doctors who are excellent at what they do, and I would trust them with my life and with my healthcare. But as a business person, you know, some lack in some places. So but you kind of got both under wraps right there.
Yeah, I always loved operations. I love operations. I love puzzles. Mm-hmm. So math, I was a true STEM person. You know, it was interesting. In high school, my high school had a very good academic decathlon team. And they'd asked me to be on the team because my math skills, and I was just like, it's not my thing. I have things going on over the summer because they compete in the summer, but they actually had me teach the math portion to the team, and they ended up going international. And so I was teaching my peers early. Math came to me very easily. And I was a problem solver, and I love operations. Like, how do you solve for big problems? To me, that is the most enjoyable type of thing. And so I got my MBA while I was in medical school as a dual program. I always kept my foot in both doors. I worked at Deloitte. I did risk management consulting. I ran business consultancy, you know, certain units. And so I did reach a point where I said, you know, I want to do something different. I'm still seeing patients. I practice. I did four operations yesterday and do it dually. So I run both. I'm sitting at WeWork today. And yesterday in the mornings, I sit in my medical office, and then I run over here. And Wednesdays, I'm between my medical office and my WeWork office. And today I'll be at WeWork all day, and tomorrow I'll be working out of my medical office. And I do both. And it's just long days. You know, I started at 6 yesterday and finished at 7, 13 hours. And it works at work. And part of kind of where the polymath part comes, Mike, is I have to say was, because there is some issues that you would actually be interested in, but our kids' school and synagogue, I was, you know, the treasurer. I managed a multi-million dollar budget. I took them through COVID, did the readjustments. I was the spreadsheets guy. I moved all the money and was involved in the board. And so between all of those, I've always been able to kind of keep myself. There's something I told myself, and maybe worth, I always say, I tell my kids at least, is very few people learn the skills that they do for a living in college. Right. Obviously, there's a foundation we learn, but do you really learn in college like this is what I'm going to do? Now, coders, yes, maybe a lot of people do these code camps now. But, you know, even in medicine, I learned my medical stuff mostly in medical school. But that's unique because you go to school and law is different. But there's so many jobs out there where people come on the job and they learn it within 3-4 months, and then they're prolific at that job. But it's not what they learned in college. And I remember when I realized this, but it always hit me is, most people learn on the job, which means that if I put my mind to it on most other things, if I just sit there and stare at it for a couple of months, I can do it too. And I really believe in that. Sure, you know, there's always exceptions. Mm-hmm. And so not that no one has a skill that I, Alan, can't do. I don't think of it like that. But I just that most people learn on the job, which means that that skill doesn't need a college education to be able to do that job. And so I do tell my kids that don't ever think you're locked as you get older. You will be able to be, you know, very variable. You can be flexible and move around. Sure. And for myself, it's been that, you know, you want to do this, go do it. You know, most anyone else who's doing it learned it while they did it.
I've learned that's specifically true for business. You know, you don't learn business until you actually do business.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd probably be skeptical if I met a surgeon that didn't go to school to learn how to do surgery and just learned on a job.
I would be there with you. So, you know, the original model was The Apprentice, you know, way back when, where it'd be, you know, a young kid and would just follow along and then just try to make it up on the way. But, you know, surgery has come a long way in the last 40 years. It was not so long ago that they would have a textbook stand in the operating room and the surgeon would be using a manual to figure out what they're doing as they're going. And that's definitely changed.
I guess that's why they call it a practice, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, there was one of my procedures yesterday. We came out and I told her, I have seen a lot of things and this is the first time I've seen it. And so we're going through a whole kind of set of things because it was a very unique situation.
Okay. Now, where did you graduate school from?
So I graduated from UCLA for undergrad. I went to Temple Medical School, Fox okay. School of Business, and then I did my fellowship at University of Pennsylvania.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And you're an instructor at Cedars-Sinai, correct?
Yeah. So we're teaching, so work with the residents and the fellows for Department of Surgery, Division of Colorectal. And so we have teaching conferences. We had one last night. So I did my medical work, worked at USO, and then wrapped the night up with a teaching conference. That's every Wednesday, every Monday night we have teaching. And then we teach the residents as we operate, which is safer. I always tell people, they're always like, I don't want a resident. Understand that for most surgeries, you need an assistant. And okay. so my assistant could be another board certified doctor or not board, but let's just say a physician who is licensed and who is training daily on how to do a surgery, or a random nurse that the OR is going to give me because there's no one else available. You want the resident there. You just want to know you have a physician that you know is in charge and knows what they're doing. But then you have two people with expertise on you rather than just one.
Well, that's good. That's good. So for those listening who are thinking about side gigs, you kind of have a side gig as a surgeon, although, you know, how do you get into it? It takes a lot of education, a lot of practice. But have you always wanted to be a doctor, or is that just something that, you know, I don't assume you wake up one day and say, I think I'm going to be a colonoscopist or,
well. It's colorectal is a late decision. Yes, I've always wanted to be a physician. I want to stay a physician. I don't see that facet of my life leaving. I do come from a family where everyone was a physician.
Okay.
And everyone being, you know, I think I have like 15 cousins. Every single first cousin is a physician of some sort, be it a medical doctor or an optometrist or a dentist, all of them. So it's very deep on our family, on both sides, by the way, not just on my dad's side, but even on my mom's side. So partly it's just the way our family kind of saw the world, but I also very much enjoy it.
Right, right. So, you know, what we share in common, I'll let the audience know, is that we both claim to have a background or an interest in libertarianism.
Yeah.
And I was thinking the person who introduced me to that whole thing was Dr. Ron Paul, if you're familiar.
Yeah. I donated to him.
And so, you know, when you talk about political issues, you know, especially since we mentioned earlier that healthcare is a major concern for people, I like to get a grasp on the industry as a whole from somebody who's actually working in the industry. What I don't like is you get on TV, you find somebody who says, this is what we need to do to solve these problems, and they have no background in the medical industry at all. They have no experience. They don't know what they're talking about. And then it seems like a lot of doctors, you know, you have a conversation with them. And this is, I think, where the corruption comes in. You know, they might love what they do. They might have an interest, a background. They, you know, their family was also doctors, like you're mentioning. They have a love for the industry, but then somehow that political element gets them corrupted and we have all kinds of problems.
I agree. I mean, it's multifaceted. So Ron Paul, I knew very well, not personally. I wish I did. He's awesome. And he was a physician too, right? OB-GYN. My journey was, I was in college at UCLA and somebody gave me Larry Elder's book. What was it? There's 10, basically the idea that there's the dimes, the difference between Republicans and Democrats. And I found it exceedingly interesting. And at that point, Larry Elder clearly stood as himself as libertarian. And so I started looking into it and reading on it. And I got into David Boaz, he has the Libertarian Reader. And Cato Institute had, I don't know if they still have it, but they have a summer scholarship program where you could go for a week and sit at a conference with other speakers. And so I applied for that, got the scholarship, and drove down to that and stayed for a week at this hotel. Met, you know, Milton Friedman, son David Friedman. There's a bunch of people I'd met there. D. Roy Murdoch. Was a really good event. And my roommate, because they paired us up, because everything was paid, even the hotel, he introduced me to Ayn Rand. And I will tell you, my journey through all of this has been interesting. I find, I think Rand is greatly misunderstood for what she has contributed to the world in terms of understanding the ills of a communist regime and knowing herself. They utilize, you know, her peculiarities in sexuality as a way to demonize her. Meanwhile, Rihanna writes, you know, if you look at like Rihanna's music, it's all about S&M. You know, it's almost like they have the same sexual proclivities. And that's okay. It's a heroism on that front. her, you know, proclivities don't work for me. And I also think that she had this kind of fallout with Nathaniel Braden. This is how far I get onto it. But he had argued that with her, and I think they were lovers, and I may be wrong, so I apologize, but that was my understanding, that somebody could still be an objectivist and still believe in religion. And she was an absolutist that that can't be. And I disagree with her. I think he was actually right on this, and maybe that's hearsay. And the reason is, you know, I do think that there are certain things that, for instance, there are ways that we control education. And I know I'm avoiding yet how to get a healthcare. We'll get there. But there's ways to talk about or move people. The thing that the big war in America right now is not Russia, Ukraine. It's a culture war. That's the war. That's the cold war in America right now, is the culture war. And it's what, and it's what's interesting is how few people are, who are the kind of the leading head speakers, are so just unaware, or just, I don't know, they lack, they're just so unaware. They, the reason Trump won, and he had a myriad of issues, but the reason he won was the culture war. They, you know, Obama was so poised and well-spoken that it was this, you know, people just could not see what was happening at the end of the day. We were in an economic crisis. Yeah. We were in an economic crisis his last year, and his number one issue wasn't the economy, it was transgender bathrooms. People don't forget this, but it was. Mm-hmm. Our school changed their bathroom signs his last year of the presidency, because that was first and foremost the most important thing. Now, he spoke well, but that was his number one issue, not the economy. And so they missed that. As a reaction to the culture war, you had a cultural warrior with all his faults, you know, and so, and it wasn't about economics. It wasn't about business. It wasn't about the lies. It was, there was a, it, there was a reaction inside where people are saying, you are going against my core understanding of the world. And so I'm kind of going all over the place right now.
But, sorry, I'm usually all over the place myself.
Yeah, so. But you know, I think the culture war for us is the big, is what is really driving everything in America now. Mm-hmm. And it's, everyone's going, you know, we'll go into that. But so back to kind of Braden and Rand, was I do think that you can't, so I lost it and now I know where it was. So there was an idea to me as I looked at these things, and I think a lot of it goes to, if you look at kind of the left, and I mean not Democrats, I actually think there's a very big distinction between a Democrat and a leftist. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're one and the same at all. That they live through crises. Everything is a crisis, not just the Rahm Emanuel line, don't let a crisis go to waste. If you look at the last year, every moment of our lives has been a crisis, from climate change to the COVID virus, to the transgender issues, to be, it's a crisis of disproportionate things that if we don't act now, there's no longer a part of the left that is not acting on crisis every single moment.
Correct. Yeah.
And it's exhausting. People are tired. Now, why I brought all this up is there is a part of me that does believe that the fundamental issue, how do we, for instance, deal with militant Islam? You know, and I'm not talking about Islam in general. There's good Muslims out there, but militant Islam that wants to kill everyone and wants Sharia law across the planet. It's an education of some sort to break them from religion. And so, you know, I was a full evolutionist. I'd gone through all that, evolution is everything. And then I went to med school and I started learning about the human body. And I was, there was parts of me that was like, I actually don't buy this anymore. It was learning the body that made me question. And this isn't that I don't believe in evolution. I fully believe in evolution. You know, evolution happens. What I do question is, can an amoeba turn into a human being? That part.
Mm.
I'm not saying it can happen. Everyone's like, oh, science is proven. Have you heard that term before? The science is proven.
Right, exactly.
What does the science proven do? It pulls you away from the culture and thoughts that you have. And I've seen that pattern multiple times, where the science is proven has been used to tell people not to think in some specific way. And evolution is one of those. And this was way before the science was proven was a line, but I was learning about, you know, one of the ones, for instance, is our endocrine system. We have hormones where a hormone has to be released from my brain, mm-hmm. and its only purpose is to find another organ in the rest of my body. It's its only thing it does. So what that means on an evolutionary basis is, one, I have to have this organ make the hormone. At the same time, another organ exists to receive that hormone so that its effect is felt. And then three, it has to be a germline mutation. It has to change in a way to be passed on to my children. There's a lot of things that have to happen simultaneously
right.
on multiple fronts to make all these different organs. Doesn't mean, sure, the world is a gazillion years old, but it's not a gazillion. We're saying a billion. So there's parts of it that's like, maybe this isn't right. And you know, you learn in physics, there's all these other realms. They say there's six other dimensions that we do not know how to tap. And so I wouldn't say I became religious, but I became spiritual, as in it's not so far-fetched that maybe there's something that I don't see out there that is involved. And that this simplistic idea that an amoeba turned into a human was really a way to push us away from deep religion because of where it's coming from. And so I'd say I moved much more to agnosticism. I still am culturally and heritagely a Jew. Mm-hmm. That's my history. It's where we come from. I don't pray. I don't keep kosher. But I do believe there probably is something out there that I just have no way to define or know what it is. I actually think that to me is more plausible than that story. And it was through medical school that I started to question it. And so that was where the absolutism with Rand, where she basically, you know, pushed him up right in, and now you have the objectivist center versus, you know, objectivism, I think was missed. But overall, I think they're right that the world is what it is and you have to accept it for what it is. You know, you don't define this computer, it just exists. And so much of what we're hearing now in this new culture war is the opposite. My truth is the exact opposite.
Right.
Exact. There mm-hmm. is no my truth. It is just the truth, not my truth. But yeah, sorry, I went on a monologue.
No, that's
proportions there.
That's perfect, Doctor. Because of the fact that that's usually how my conversations go. Very Joe Rogan, just talk less time. No, but that. My introduction to libertarianism started with Ayn Rand as well. And, you know, I actually have a religious background. And so like at some point I'm like, I don't agree with her because of, you know, that's not the right word. Her, you know, she doesn't like religion. Okay. Yep. But then I'm going to tie back in. I'm going to use my wife as a story here. You know, she actually was a premature birth, and, you know, she wholeheartedly believes that, you know, although the doctors helped, you know, her survive, that it was a miracle that she's still alive. Right. So that word miracle, you know, I don't know if that exists in any science medical textbooks, but I believe it's true. And you can't take that away from people.
I think it's there. And I do think it's something I really do believe. Take the word God out of religion for a minute. Mm-hmm. Why people think, well, I don't believe in God, so I'm an atheist. And, you know, and I just use the word agnostic. So not to be, you know, hypocritical, but I did that because that is the language. I don't think when people say there's atheists, I don't think, by and large, generally speaking, there truly is a true category of atheist at all. Because in my estimation, religion isn't based on the belief in God. Religion is based on an understanding of the world. Mm. End stop. No person has the capacity to know everything in the world. And so at some point, as a matter of faith, you accept some tenets on how the world works from people that you trust, be them the elders of the faith you believe in.
Sure, absolutely.
God or no God, period. And it all, you know, it was listening to Jordan Peterson on Joe Rogan. You just mentioned Rogan. And the first Jordan Peterson episode on Rogan, he's had a few, but the very first one was one of the most profound, profound conversations on religion ever. Because what he tied it to was that there's a central core story that humans need and they relate to. And you see it in the Harry Potter stories, you see it in the Marvel movies mm-hmm. about the hero and the anti-hero.
Absolutely. I've talked about the hero's journey and Joseph yeah. Campbell before. So.
Yeah. And I think it's right. And I think there's a reason it's right that we may not understand. But even when you look at the far left that says we're atheists, we're anti-religion, we're woke, we're this, we're that, and they're tearing everything down, they still follow all the same patterns. Mm-hmm. Their priests are politicians. Their Jesus was Obama. I mean, he really was. Their elders are the talking heads, but they all fit the same purpose. And it's regardless of God. And the key is that whatever is said as a matter of faith, and there's an orthodoxy to how they act. And I actually see the issue happening in the US and why everyone's talking about these upcoming midterms being a landslide. This isn't Republican, Democrat. This isn't right, left. This is woke against everyone else.
Right.
And that's
right.
when you're going to see this midterm landslide that everyone's predicting, because you're getting suburban moms and people who would typically not vote conservative, vote conservative because this isn't coming to be conservative-led, non-conservative. This is the entire country right now.
Well, right. You mentioned a culture war, and I think that especially the people I've been listening to and following have really pointed out, we've seen that develop over the last 2 years with the, well, I'll call it the COVID regime, right? And I think that you're right, that you know, whether people believe in, you know, Jesus Christ or Muhammad or whoever their God or spiritual leader is, without that, they're still inclined to worship something, right?
Yeah. Everyone worships something. They do.
And so we have these personalities on TV, and I'm just gonna put it out there, and you can say what you want about it. But you know, we have the almighty Dr. Fauci, who's basically dictating everyone's medical decision for the entire planet, and he's just a politician, in my opinion. I don't think he's practiced medicine for a long time. He's a bureaucrat, but to some people, he's a god, right? And what the system has done is they've actually silenced people like you, who actually have experience, have a knowledge, have a desire to help. But, you know, I'm sorry, before today or before last week, I never heard of, you know, I had never heard of you.
Yeah. I mean, it's power, right? What in the Fountainhead, what Rand makes a big point, that the thing she dislikes and the ultimate evil is that seeking of power. Those are the things that people miss, of how profound of a statement that is. It's very profound. If you really just sit back and think about what is she saying, because so much of the human psyche is, my success is based on some conception of power, be it that because I am a really famous news anchor, I get to yell at people behind the scenes. That's a power struggle rather than self-fulfillment. And so, you know, it's hard on the medical side to your question, like, because, you know, they have silenced physicians. So it's very hard for me to speak publicly about what's happening. You know, even with the whole Rogan podcast on Spotify, because he had a physician who had a contrarian view, they wanted to cancel the whole show. I mean, it's ultimately what people don't realize is that the woke movement at its core functions through bullying. They are the movement of bullying through and through. They are all bullies. They will bully you out of a job. They don't mind ruining someone's livelihood if it doesn't agree with what they think. I mean, that's a religion. Sure, only an absolutely. Orthodox extreme religion does that to people who don't conform. And they bully. I mean, that's the whole concept through, and like, historic. That's what you look at, like, just other models historically. That's it. It's a repetition. It's just, we don't believe in God. Okay, sure. Take God out. But every other facet of what an Orthodox religion has, you have. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And you know, following blindly. And to what you said, he wasn't speaking it. Now, you know, early on when this was all happening, before any of the mandates, any of this, well, you know, they shut down. What I said early, before even physicians were not allowed to talk, I said, the mistake they're making is that they're letting physicians make the final decision. And that shouldn't be, right? The way a board works, or a board of advisors, is you have the president or the head or the CEO, and that person's job is to say, I have competing variables. And from my medical side, they're telling me, on a medical standpoint, this is what we do. Okay, stop. On a commerce side, what would that mean? Okay, now you two, let's talk. How do we balance those two? And let's balance those and figure out a solution based off what they're saying. But what had happened was, it became just end stop. The CDC says, boom, with no other consideration. What happens to children psychologically? What happens to anxiety disorders? What happens to the minority children who were the most hurt? Talk about not a conflict of interest. You want to help minorities? COVID hurt more than any other culture, the socioeconomically downtrodden. They didn't have what I had. We built a pod in our house, in our backyard, and every day we'd have tutors come with different kids, and our kids would socialize with a set pod of kids, and they excelled. You could afford that. But what about these kids that barely had the computers? They are now 2 years behind academically. Mm-hmm. And that's forever. They're not going to get that time back.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know, but, oh, well, COVID, we saved, you know, six kids. Good job. You know, forget about all the kids who have now committed suicide and who are now, for the rest of their lives, are educationally stunted because of what you've done. It was so blindsided because they took one view and forgot about the roundtable discussion.
it's just a bureaucratic political nightmare. And, you know, I think that we're going to be learning lessons, or at least talking about lessons, for the, you know, for decades after this. Hopefully we, you know, we don't repeat some of the same tragedies that took place. But, you know, Alan, I really appreciate your time. I feel like we can talk forever. You know, one question that really strikes with me is, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you're working 13 hours a day, and obviously you can't do that indefinitely, but having a family and having a business, being a surgeon, how do you balance all that stuff? How do you do it?
Well, I'm Invictus. No, so.
Hey, you can't answer that question until I ask you.
So, you know, I'm fortunate enough that sleep is something that my body doesn't need too much of.
Okay.
Now that I'm in my 40s, I need about 4 or 5 hours, but for the longest time, 2 to 3 hours was my consistent basis for, I could go, it sounds crazy and but it's true. Anyone who knows me will tell you, because they always talk about my weird sleep habits, but I used to be able to go 2 to 3 hours and I'd be fine. And I would be able to repeat that for 2-3 weeks at a time. And then I would take one night and sleep like 7 hours. And to me, that was like a makeup for what it was. So I typically get up at 4:35 most mornings. I'll either run, swim, or bike. I didn't today for some reason, but yesterday I didn't because I was operating. But typically, you know, because I do the triathlon thing because I suck at it, but because it keeps me healthy. I'm really awful. My times are just disgraceful, but knowing that I have an event coming up makes me get up and do the event. So I just sign up for, you know, the Santa Cruz Half Ironman in September, and that'll force me to make sure I stay in shape so I don't completely suck, because I just suck when I do train. But the big one that I enjoyed, by the way, was I did the Alcatraz try. And because I have a tremendous fear of sharks that is seeded from watching Jaws as a kid, illogical. I've tried everything in my power to beat it. I can't. Everyone's like, well, no, you're not scared. You swim in the ocean. I was like, I swim the ocean in beaches. Quite literally, if I'm doing a race and it's in the ocean, I will do a historical record search for shark attacks at that beach.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so that's my way of overcoming it. So, you know, the beach I swim in Santa Monica, the last shark attack was in the 50s, and it was a fisherman's boat and his son was swimming by the line. So even that was excusable. And so that's how deep I get to feel, to be able to at least handle kind of this illogical fear, but to get through it. So Alcatraz is a big deal to me, because in my mind, that bay, there's urban legends. I don't know, but I just don't think it's safe. So it was a big deal to swim through the harbor from Alcatraz back to, I always forget the part, but at the base of Golden Gate Bridge is where we got out of the water.
Yeah, I've actually been to San Francisco and on the Rock. How far is it? Is that like a mile swim or something?
It's a 1.8 mile swim.
1.8 mile. Okay.
Yeah. And it was exhilarating. So I'll do that, and then I work, and then I make a point. My team knows it. Once I go home, I will not go out of my computer unless I have to. So that is family time. So work is work. I'm highly efficient. I'm exceedingly organized. So I get things done very quickly. And that means that when I close my computer, I go home, short of an emergency that, you know, you have to get in, or I have to run to the hospital. Right. But I won't sit there and be like, now I'm going to go do more work once I get home. Home is work, homework. I'm with the kids. That's my wife. If I want to watch TV just to decompress, I will do that. And weekends, I protect myself too. So okay. I will keep an eye on my phone. I always see emails as they come. Is it urgent or not? But it keeps me going and lets me kind of get a lot done in the day.
Well, great. There's a lot of underlying clues right there to have anybody learn about how to be successful. I don't know if I can handle a 2 to 3 hour of sleep thing, but you know.
Well, now I'm at like 4 to 5. Okay. So getting older, it's starting to hit me. But yeah.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
But you know, I want to let you share whatever you need to have people get a hold of you. I like I said, I really like the uso.com that I have. I really like that idea, that concept of crowdfunding health insurance. You know, your company is obviously directed at pets, but you know, why don't you just? I already gave the website, but why don't you just share again how people can you know, look more into that.
Yeah, no. So USOH is, it's EUSOH. So we spell the U like Europe, EUSOH.com. And our pilot is in pet. The whole idea was you can't reinvent the model of coverage from the ground up, which we really did, and just go crazy. And so let's find a small market, go live in it, make it good, and then apply it widely. And we're at that phase now where we're getting ready to launch it outside the pet market. Our pet market was basically a proof of concept, which it did with flying colors.
Awesome. Awesome. Glad to hear. All right. Well, Dr. Kamrava, Are you Invictus?
I believe so.
Awesome.
I think so. I mean, it's hard to self-judge, but my take on that is, you know, I think one of your other guest speakers said resilience. I think resilience is part of that. I'm definitely resilient. I don't think Invictus means you don't fail at times. It's that you, how you respond to failure. I've had my many, many failures. And I think an Invictus person doesn't look at failure as a stop. It's just, that's a learning lesson.
Well, you're absolutely right. You can't be as successful as you have been without a few failures along the way. So
yeah.
I respect that. And I appreciate this conversation.